Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
All right, it's Dave Player on 720 WGN. Charlie Brown Christmas is a television classic. The show went on to win both the Emmy and Peabody Award and was the first of over 40 animated Peanuts specials created by the legendary creator of Peanuts, Charles Schulz. Animator Bill Melendez and our guest tonight, Emmy and Peabody winning television producer Lee Mendelson. Lee, happy holidays to you.
Thank you very much. Merry Christmas to you.
Now, you've been working in television for well over five decades, and
correct,
some of your early influences included the golden age of radio, I heard.
Yes, of course, when I grew up in the West Coast, there was just radio. There was no television, and had all kinds of influences through the radio programs. In fact, a lot of them emanated from San Francisco, where I grew up, and I think some of the first soap operas were from there. And eventually, we did the 50th anniversary of broadcasting with Arthur Godfrey and Lucille Ball and Bing Crosby. So growing up with radio, I was always interested in communication, not realizing I would be in television someday. Although, ironically, when I graduated from Stanford in 1954, my professor said, "I recommend you stay in radio because I think television's only a fad."
A lot of people said that back then. That's
right.
That's
how far back I go in radio, yeah.
Sure. Now, you were a fan of comic strips as well, and comics when you were a kid. What were some of your favorites? What did you enjoy? Because Peanuts started in 50, so when you were a kid, it was a little bit before that. What did you enjoy?
Oh, yeah, when I was a kid, it was The Phantom and The Counting of the Kids and Little Orphan Annie and, you know, all your, and Dick Tracy and Joe Palooka and all the ones from the 40s and 50s. Because comic strips, you know, well, now they're about 120 years old. They started at the turn of the last century. And, of course, Charlie Brown was the first comic strip to deal with feelings, with the one exception maybe of Pogo, which dealt with the environment. But Charlie Brown was the first one that dealt with unrequited love and bulliness and all those kind of things. So that made him stand apart from all the, you know, 80, 90 years of comics before that.
Sure. Did your interest in radio, the comics, influence your decision to get into the business yourself, or was that not as clear in respect to what you wanted to get into when you were in high school and college?
No, I never really thought about it. I really wanted to be a writer, and I wrote a couple of plays when I was in college, and then I went in the Air Force. And when I got out of the Air Force, and I was working for my dad for a while, I noticed they were starting to do local documentaries in San Francisco on the television stations there. So I decided, you know, that I'd like to see if I could get a job somewhere on the West Coast and get into some kind of documentary production. And then in 1961, I was lucky. I got a job offer at KPIX, which is the CBS affiliate. Mm-hmm. So I spent 2 years there and did about 80 documentaries while I was there.
You know, that's a big deal, though, starting in a big market like that on a station like that.
I was very lucky. I would have taken, you know, anything. I just happened to walk in one day when a production assistant found out she was pregnant and quit on the spot. And I walked in and they hired me for 1 month and then I stayed there for 2 years.
And you were doing some PSAs and so forth, but that led to your interest in these documentaries you were mentioning. And the first one was this 1915 San Francisco World's Fair that brought some interest to you.
Well, I was driving over the Golden Gate Bridge and thought that would be a good show to do. So we did it on the Gothic Bridge. Then we did the 1915 World's Fair, which I found in an antique shop in Tiburon. Some guy had a 35mm film there from 1915. And then we did the earthquake, 1906 earthquake. We did San Simeon.
This 1915 World's Fair, though, that you found this footage. First of all, footage was very rare, obviously, video footage at that time.
I walked into an antique store. I haven't been in one before or since. I don't know why I walked in. This little Chinese fellow said, "I have some 35mm film." I told him I was in television. He said, "You can have it." And I took it in, and we figured out what it was, the 1915 World's Fair.
Wow.
It was unbelievable. My dad walked me over the bridge when it opened in 1937. I was 4 years old. didn't dream that I'd be 25 years later doing a show on how the whole thing was built.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And you were able to talk to some of those people that built the bridge.
You got all the riveters and the painters, everybody. It was fabulous. Because they all had come out during the Depression to work on the bridge, and they all stayed here. And then we found out from Bethlehem Steel they had all the movies of the whole construction of the bridge, so that became a big hit.
That must have made you hungry, because that just sounds exciting, just the steps to put this together. First of all, discovering the content and the footage right. that you had and so forth, and then interviewing all these people and bringing it all together. Yeah.
It was all thrilling and all serendipity.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. Now, you produced a documentary on Willie Mays, which you hailed as one of the greatest baseball players ever. And when you saw a Peanuts comic strip, and it inspired you to do something on the world's worst player, which
when I quit KPIX, the first show we did on speculation is with Willie Mays, and we sold it to NBC, and it was a big hit. And yes, and then I said, hey, Charlie Brown's lost 900 games. Let's do the world's worst player, having done the world's best. And called Schultz on the phone. He was always in the phone book. He was not interested. He said, I'm just want to do my comic strip. I want to focus on the comic strip. I've heard from Hollywood and New York. I don't want to be bothered. I said, well, I understand that. I was just about to hang up. And I said, but anyway, any chance did you see the Willie Mays documentary a month ago? He said, yes, I loved it. He's a hero of mine. Why do you ask? I said, well, there's a three-man crew. That's our crew. We did that show, and we'd like to do the same thing with you. And there was a long pause, and he said, well, if Willie Mays is willing to risk his life on you, maybe I am. Why don't you come up and let's talk? And that's how we did the documentary. I mean, I was 3 seconds from hanging up the phone.
That's wild. And we have to look back and say, Charles Schultz started Peanuts in 1950. So at that time, it was already, in the papers that we recognized for like 15 years.
Yeah, he was a huge success by 1963. And the first Snoopy dolls came out, the calendars, all that was rolling too.
And it was first called Little Folks, right? I mean, that was his first. It wasn't called Peanuts right up front when he first started dabbling in it.
In Minneapolis, when he was in the art instruction school, his original drawings were called Little Folks. When he sold the idea to the syndicate in New York, they changed it to Peanuts, which he always hated, but he accepted.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, he hated that name.
Well, what's funny, too, is in its height, this comic strip was published daily in 2,600 papers, 75 countries. 21 different languages, iconic as you could get. I mean, everybody recognized these characters no matter where they went.
And he drew 18,000 comic strips over 50 years and never missed a day.
So we were talking in 1965, Coca-Cola approached you, Lee, to produce a holiday special for television. Tell us about that.
So Coca-Cola called in 1965 when a Time magazine cover story about the Charlie Brown characters came out. And they said, if you folks that did the documentary, which we like, I ever thought of doing a Christmas show. And I said, absolutely. And they said, well, we need an outline in 2 days down here in Atlanta. I said, no problem. I hung up. I called Mr. Schultz. I said, I think I just sold a Charlie Brown Christmas show. And he said, what in the world is that? And I said, it's something you're going to write tomorrow. And there was another long pause. He said, all right, we can do it. Have Melendez come up and we'll meet tomorrow. Figure out something. So we met the next day, came up with all the ideas for Charlie Brown Christmas that eventually came out 6 months later and on the CBS. We had to give them an outline first. And so we did the outline, and we said, we're going to use real kids. We're going to use Vince Guaraldi again with jazz and Beethoven and traditional cute music. We're going to do a Christmas play to show all the pressure on kids at Christmas time. We're going to use real kids, not adults. And we're going to have Linus read from the Bible and so forth and so on. Sent the outline by Western Union back then to Atlanta. They bought the outline. They bought the show. And then, of course, Bill Melendez had a storyboard it after Charles Schultz wrote the dialogue. And that was the second step.
Now, the main story, as you were saying, was to focus on the true meaning of Christmas. And even back then, 50 years ago, we were talking about the commercialization of Christmas and how it's gotten.
Right. It hasn't changed much. And the paradox, of course, is there's nothing more commercial than Charlie Brown products. And, of course, over the years, Charles Schulz has said, you know, all I do, I'm a cartoonist and I draw funny pictures. And I hope people like them. And if they want to buy products, that's not my thing. That's for other companies to determine. But all I can do is to draw my comic strip and not worry about the other side of it.
Well, and at a time, too, where everything, especially today, and even back then, was overly politically correct, tackling religion and calling it a Christmas special, that was a little bit controversial at the time, too.
Well, it didn't turn out to be controversial. Bill Melendez, I thought it might be. We were done outlining the show, and at the last minute, Mr. Schulz said, I think we should have Linus read from the Bible. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, if we're going to do a Christmas show, you know, we ought to talk about what Christmas is really about. And I remember Bill looked at me, and I looked at him, and I said, maybe that's going to be a problem. And I said, you know, I've never heard of animating anything from the Bible. And he said, well, if we don't do it, who will, Mr. Schulz? So we ended up doing it, and we never had any question for anybody after that. Nobody ever questioned it. It just became part of the show.
Which is wonderful. Which is wonderful. Now, how did the Charlie Brown Christmas tree come about? Because that is such an iconic part, not only of this special, but of Christmas. Like my son, you know, when he puts up his tree in his room, it's a Charlie Brown Christmas tree. Because that's what makes him smile and think about, you know, the holidays.
Yeah. Well, I had read the Hans Christian Andersen little fir tree story to my kids the year before. So I said to Mr. Schulz, maybe we could do something about a little tree like that. And he thought about, you know, what kind of tree it would look like. And then Bill Melendez designed it. And the weirdest thing is when we got the Emmy the following year, the man who handed it to me was Danny Kaye. And what did Danny Kaye star in? Hans Christian Andersen.
That's cool.
I mean, talk about surreal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's where the tree came from.
Well, the tree's so iconic, but now here, you know, when you're putting together the special, Peanuts was a comic strip for nearly 15 years by 1965. There were no voices.
That's right.
And now you had to put voices to all of the characters.
Right.
Now, you really had to, you know, I'm sure Mr. Schulz in his mind knew what the attitude and the voices were of a character, but after 15 years of drawing them, now it has to happen.
Again, we thought Charlie Brown should be very blah.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought, well, Lucy was just a typical girl. We had no problem with her. And that Linus should show some kind of innocence. And that's the voices we went for. And they all worked really well on the Christmas show. And then every 2 years thereafter, we just emulated those voices. So we put some shows together on a given night. They were 30 years apart, but you can't tell the difference with the voices. We've been very lucky with that. The most famous voice was a lady who played Sally for us for 2 or 3 years, and her name was Stacey Ferguson, and she went on to become Fergie. So she was our most famous talent.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And here it is, these kids, though, instead of voiceover artists, so that was a big deal, is using actual children. These kids, a lot of these kids were from your own neighborhood.
Well, some of them were from Hollywood, for the main, you know, three, because we used them in a documentary, and some of them were from my neighborhood, so there was a mix of professionals and non-professionals.
Which made it more realistic.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Tell me a little bit about Bill Melendez. He was a former Disney guy, correct?
Yeah, he worked on all the great Disney movies, Pinocchio and Dumbo and
Fantasia.
And then he became an independent producer, and he and Schulz got together to do a Ford commercial in 1962. That's how they became friends. And his great genius was to move characters from the comic page into animation, you know, not change them, not cartoon them up or make things here and there. So he kept them very simple, and that was the genius that I think made the whole thing work. It made it a seamless transition.
Well, and only 6 months to put it together. I mean, this was very tight to put something together like this.
Well, he said the same. You know, when I said to Bill, can you do this in 6 months? He said, absolutely. And I said, wait a minute. That sounds very familiar. He had no idea if he could do it, but he did it.
That's very cool. And the music, you're mentioning Vince Guaraldi, so iconic. Yeah. You know, it's a jazz soundtrack. It's gone triple platinum in the U.S. because it's just such a popular album. Now, the special opens and closes with a choir of children. And I read this was culled from St. Paul's Episcopal Church in San Rafael, California.
San Rafael. Yes, what happened, he had been working with a children's choir to do a jazz mass in San Francisco, a very famous one. And when the show was done, the opening scene and skating with this instrumental, a beautiful song, and I said, maybe we could get some words to this. And I called around. I couldn't find any lyricist who would do it. So I sat down at my dining room table and just squared out the words to Christmas Time Is Here. Wow. Handed the words to Vince. He went to the children's choir, and they recorded it that weekend, and we added that to the show.
Wow.
And then they did Hark the Herald Angels Sing at the End. And the critic said, Mendelssohn wrote the opening and closing song, and I called him up, and I said, wait a minute. I wrote Christmas Time Is Here. I didn't write Hark the Herald Angels Sing.
Although that'd be great. Said, that'd be great, some great
he
money.
Said, no. He said, no, but Felix Mendelssohn did.
Oh, is
I
that right?
That was
interesting.
Very cool.
Interesting,
right.
Yeah. A Charlie Brown Christmas.
Go ahead, sir. We just did a show called It's Your 50th Christmas, Charlie Brown, hosted by Kristen Bell and all the great mm-hmm. music from Charlie Brown. And it's going to be repeated on December 24th on ABC. It did so well, they're going to run it again.
Yeah, very excited to hear that. Very excited to hear that. And the soundtrack was voted into the Grammy Hall of Fame in 2007. It was added to the Library of Congress's National Recording Registry list in 2012. What was the budget for a special like this back then? I can't imagine.
It was only $150,000, but that was a lot of money in 1965.
Yeah. I guess it was. Now, the program premiered on CBS in December of 1965 at 7:30. It preempted the Munsters, did some research here, and was viewed by 45% of those watching television that evening, with about 16 million people, placing it behind Bonanza, but still a respectable rating.
There were only three networks back then, and we were staggered. You know, we couldn't believe it. And I think that's why we kept our audience for 50 years, because that number was so huge that they became fans, and then their children and grandchildren became fans. So it was that opening that really was terrific. But we're only like, I don't know, 130 million people in America back then.
Well, and that, and, you know, really, we had three channels, as you said, but it was so etched into our minds that if you didn't see it, by the way, that Christmas, you didn't see it. There was no videotape. There was no VHS.
No,
there was no
right.
DVD. You didn't see it. You didn't see it. So people really parked themselves in front of the television, ran on CBS through 2000 and ABC ever since, and still to great ratings.
Yeah, it's all surreal, all serendipity, as I said earlier.
Lee Mendelssohn, thank you so much for joining us, my friend, and happy holidays to you and your family.
It's my pleasure. I want to thank Chicago and the Midwest. They always give us great ratings.
Fantastic.
And also,